Okay, thank you. Before I begin, I want to begin by saying that this is a collaborative effort. Its work includes people like Wade French, who is from the USD Brookings Lab, who supplied the insects, and was really instituted initially by Art Schaffsma, who is also at the University of Guelph, but at our Ridgetown campus. And the work represents primarily the work of Frey Garibagi, who is a postdoc. The objective here is to find a marker for the rotation-resistant western corn rootworm. And Tom already mentioned one approach, which is to test a range of random markers and see if you can find an association between the phenotype and a molecular marker. And we've done some work with rapid markers to with that approach, and found the same as Tom, in that you find some markers that are at larger frequencies in the rotation-resistant individuals, but nothing that's diagnostic that says this is the reason or this is the difference. So another approach is to use a candidate gene approach. And this is a bit risky because you're essentially saying, okay, this is it, and I'm going to try it out and see. And that's the story I'm going to tell you today. The candidate gene approach in this case was initiated by some information that's available in the literature on a behavior gene in Drosophila. This behavior gene, so I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction to this gene. The behavior gene in this case determines a difference in the behavior of the larva in the presence of food. I'm afraid of touching this because it looks like it's going to advance. let's just see. Okay. So you have rovers and sitters. Rovers, when they're on a patch of food on a plate, aren't happy with that. They'll actually move out of that patch, look for other sources of food. Sitters, on the other hand, stay within that patch of food. And it's a single gene trait difference, and it's triggered by food. So if they're in a plate that's completely covered by food, then the difference is still apparent in the travel distance between rovers and sitters, but if they're on a plate with no food, they travel essentially the same. So it's not a question that the rovers or the sitters are sluggish, they just are happy with the food that they have. The sitters are, and the rovers move. work was done then to locate the position of that gene, and it was found that that gene went into a locus that coded for a cyclic guanosine monophosphate dependent protein kinase. So we'll call it PKG for short. And this particular gene, then you could transform sitters to rovers by taking the rover allele and using that for transforming the Drosophila. And rovers were associated with higher levels of the transcript and of the enzyme compared to sitters. Similar genes have also been isolated for other from other individuals. Honeybee, in this case, is a developmental difference. You have nurse bees that stay close to the hive. They're young bees. As they mature, they move from the hive to become forager bees. And again, in this case, the difference between them is the expression levels for the PKG gene. And in nematodes also, you have a difference in gene expression of a PKG that is involved in movement of the nematodes and egg laying. I'm going to skip that. in the Drosophila, the gene is quite large, about 40 kb in size, and it produces a number of different transcripts, different size transcripts here, by splicing reactions, and the one that's focused on most is the T1 transcript there. The gene itself, when you look at its structure, when it codes for into a protein, it has a number of different motifs. It has a dimerization motif. So in fact, the protein acts as a dimer. It has two cyclic GMP binding sites, and it has a kinase domain. And down here you can see the way in which it dimerizes. And when it's a dimer, this kinase here is actually inhibited by a portion of the protein. When the cyclic GMP binds, this thing opens up, and so then the kinase region here is exposed, and it can then participate in phosphorylating a protein and then have its effect. So that's the way in which people understand the function of that gene. So how did we start? We took sequences from a variety of different insects and aligned them to identify regions of high homology here, and used those with PCR to amplify out sequences. And here you can see from cDNA from Diabrotica, then we have a fragment that is the same size as what's amplified out from Drosophila. And this just shows the DNA sequence and the translation. When you do the blast for that sequence there, and then comes up with 81% identity to silkworm cyclic GMP-dependent protein kinase, and it has the motifs that I talked about before. Now, in Drosophila, the difference between sitters and rovers is related to the level of expression of that gene. And so we were also interested in looking at levels of the transcript from that gene. And so we used the ribosomal intergenic region there as an internal control for our real-time PCR studies here. So we always then compare the level of expression of the cyclic GMP, our protein compared to this internal control, okay? Our preliminary studies indicated that the foraging gene transcript was higher in heads compared to thoraxes in the insects. And our initial study then compared males and females and normals and variants. And the insects that we used in the comparison here were from established colonies that in the Brookings lab. This is real-time PCR results then, just to show that the patterns that we see behave well and give good linear plots for our to allow us to do the quantification when we put in known quantities here. So the standard curves there for both the foraging and the ITS gene. And here's the results in terms of the insects. So what we have is a difference in transcript level for the female from the variant colony. And again, it's not huge, but this is about a 10% difference, 10-20% difference is what's seen in the Drosophila as well. Going back to the Drosophila gene, we have a large gene here, which is reduced in size by splicing out the introns to give a message that's about 4.5 kb in size. And so we had begun then by taking a small portion of that gene by doing homology-based amplifications. We did another round of those kinds of amplifications to try to get more of the gene, but as we got out to the ends here, the homology-based approach broke down, and so we had to use 5' and 3' race in order to capture the ends. In Drosophila, there are actually two genes, only one which is really the foraging gene, and as I mentioned before, there are a number of different transcripts that come from that foraging gene. And so we were also interested in looking at the polymorphism or the range of transcripts that there might be, and also whether there are multiple genes. Certainly from the first part here from our amplification, we found that there are in fact different kinds of transcripts, and these fragments here all add up to something that looks very much like the foraging gene in Drosophila, but down here we also found a transcript that had a totally different sequence fused to this region here, and so in fact we think it might be coming from a pseudogene or is just a totally different splicing reaction. We don't know. But so here we have lined up three different cDNAs, and you can see in this region where we started off the cloning, there's high homology. As we go up here, then less so. Two transcripts here are very similar, but one is quite different, as I mentioned before already. In the end, when we piece it all together, we have a sequence which looks very much like the foraging gene in Drosophila. We have a coiled-coil region for the protein-protein interaction, the cyclic GMP binding region domain here, and the kinase domain. So essentially, when you translate the sequence that we do have, it looks very much like the gene that I described at the beginning. And it's when you look at the sequence in terms of what's its nearest neighbor, it's most closely related to the silkworm sequence. If you do a southern blot, looking at genomic DNA now, with the probe to the kinase region here, you in fact have two hybridization spots, both for the, so here and here. So in fact there might be two copies of this gene in the genome. There seems to be a bit of a polymorphism here. I don't know exactly what that means, but that's what we observed so far. Okay, also complicating the issue, as I mentioned before, there are multiple transcripts, and the original real-time PCR was based on primers in a region that was highly homologous, in the region where they're all similar. So then we redesigned primers to try to capture differences between those transcripts so that we could distinguish the real transcript from that pseudo transcript that I mentioned before. And when we did that, then we got, again, the same difference between normals and variants, again, in the females. and so, and the difference is a little bit better there between the normals and the variants. Another issue is whether this gene expression is developmentally dependent. And so here we're looking at expression in third instar larvae, 2-week-old adults and 4-week-old adults here. You can see that in all of those cases, the variant is always higher than the normal, but the 2-week-old adults have overall the highest levels of the expression of this gene. This is just the ANOVA that emphasizes the development, the importance of the developmental stage and the difference between the normal and the variant insects. And finally then, we really want to get down to something that is diagnostic. And when we compare the DNA sequence for the variant versus the normal, we do have a 2-nucleotide difference that affects the region that's involved in the protein-protein interaction between the normal and the variant. We still need to confirm this on many more samples to see whether it is diagnostic, totally diagnostic, but it's intriguing that it's there. So, taking a risk at the beginning, focusing on one gene, if nothing else, has given us an interesting insight into this particular gene and how it differs in expression in the development of the insect. It makes a lot of sense in terms of its connection to behavior traits in other insects, but obviously more work needs to be done to confirm whether in fact this is absolutely diagnostic for the variant. I think I've mentioned these things before. I just want to acknowledge the student here. Chris Knight was involved in the original work on the rapids, and Frey is the postdoc who did the most of the work that I talked about today. And we received funds initially from Monsanto and also from the University of Guelph to do this work. Okay, thank you.